From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. When it comes to greenhouse gases, methane is very potent stuff. It's the bulk of unburned natural gas. It's more potent than CO2, carbon dioxide, for trapping heat in the atmosphere, global warming. Yes, a bunch comes from cows. More of it comes from the oil and gas industry, leaked, bled off. Now the EPA is taking steps to rein that in. The industry says, stay out of it. This hour on Point, the push to limit oil and gas industry methane emissions in the United States. Later this hour, a look ahead at the big UN climate change conference coming up in Paris and the race to get ahead of, keep up with, climate change. Joining me first today from Washington on methane is Amy Harder, energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Amy, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me on.
So methane, this is basically the part that's coming from oil and gas. What, this is sort of unburned natural gas almost.
Right. Methane is the primary component of natural gas. And so that's why this issue makes it a little bit different than, say, regulations on carbon emissions, because methane is a product that these oil and gas companies can eventually sell. And so that's why at least some companies do not hate this regulation as much as one might think they would.
So presume what's happening here is this methane in natural gas production, in oil production as well, because they tend to kind of live together, be together. It's leaking. How's it happening?
Right. It's happening through a variety points on the production and transmission process of oil and natural gas production. At the wellhead, sometimes you see those photos, especially out in North Dakota, you see flames coming from drilling sites and production sites. That's often methane being burned off as carbon dioxide.
Yep.
And that's one way that it's being wasted, because there's not enough infrastructure, enough pipelines to move that natural gas.
But waste is not the government's interest here. It's global warming is their interest, right? They want to get at the stuff that's just going straight into the atmosphere.
Right, exactly. So one reason why this regulation is so relevant to the industry is that they're just wasting a product. And so the companies have an incentive to capture that product and sell it, and the government doesn't want it being vented into the atmosphere as methane. Now, burning it off as CO2 is a less bad option than venting it as methane. But some companies, not as much in the U.S., but in places like Russia, for example, there's a lot of venting of straight methane into the atmosphere that's going on. And so there's been an effort globally to crack down on methane emissions as well.
How big a deal is methane globally compared to CO2, carbon dioxide?
Not nearly as much. And so the way you can compare methane and carbon dioxide, so methane is a more potent gas. Scientists say that its potential to warm the planet is at least 20 times greater than carbon dioxide, but it stays in the atmosphere for a much shorter time period than carbon dioxide, around a dozen years versus thousands of years. So it's not really that one is worse than the other, it's just one has a more imminent impact on the planet. And of course, for people who live in, you know, a century or so, these methane does have a very big impact.
Now, big picture here, the Obama administration is, I mean, everybody's making commitments. We'll hear more about that, what's coming up in Paris later this year. But climate change is proceeding rapidly. We're looking at maybe the hottest year in recorded history this year. The Obama administration is saying it wants to cut emissions from oil and gas production by 45% from 2012 levels over the next decade. How important is this new proposed methane regulation in that effort?
It's very important. So the methane goal, the 40 to 45% reduction goal that the administration has laid out, goes into the administration's broader goal of reducing overall U.S. greenhouse gas emissions 26 to 28% by 2025. So within this methane goal of 40 to 45%, this EPA regulation, along with a couple of other things that EPA is doing on this front, gets the administration 20% to 30% of the way there. And it's really unclear how the administration is going to get that extra 15 to 20%. And the EPA, when it announced the regulation, didn't really give us a lot of insight into that. Some ideas that I suspect might ultimately go toward the goal is the Interior Department is also working on a regulation very similar to what EPA is doing, but looking at cutting down methane from oil and gas wells that are drilled on public lands. So that could be another way that the administration gets at its 40 to 45% goal.
But what they have on the table right now is looking not at all methane loss, but just from, is it new wells, oil and gas wells?
Right. So there's actually three regulations that were announced by the EPA this week. One, which is the biggest one, is that it's requiring the first ever federal standard to cut methane emissions from new oil and natural gas wells, so only wells that have not been drilled yet. Mm-hmm. Now, some environmentalists say that that really can't get you the bulk of the wells. There's about a million wells in the U.S. right now, and so this really isn't getting at all of those. Another regulation that the EPA announced was one that does require different kinds of pollutant reductions on oil and gas wells that are in areas of the country where there's a lot of air pollution. So that includes some in the Midwest and the Northeast. That gets about 30,000 existing wells, which is still only about 3% of the wells in the U.S. So environmentalists really want the EPA to go after and regulate existing wells. Now, of course, the oil and gas industry is unified in their opposition to do that.
What are they saying? I'm reading here that they say, well, we're already doing this. Are they or not? They're claiming big reductions over the last decade or so in methane loss at a time when there's been a lot more production, which sounds like something's going on, but still we've got a problem.
Right, right. So according to EPA data, methane emissions from the sector have actually dropped about 15% between 2005 and 2012. This is while natural gas production has gone up by about 50%. So the industry points to this data to show that they're actually making progress. And I think that's true to some extent, but EPA says that if nothing is done, methane emissions will rise about 25%. Now, going back to my comment about how methane is essentially natural gas and natural gas is a product, a lot of these companies, especially those that are heavily invested in natural gas, whether they produce it or transmit it or burn it for electricity, they have a very big business incentive to capture this. So there are some companies that are working with EPA to address this issue. Other companies that are more invested in oil have less of a financial incentive to really engage on this.
I mean, do they have oil prices, for one, are so low now compared to where they've been? Does that reduce the incentive to capture it? Is it more economical for them to drill cheap and dirty?
Right, exactly. That's one concern that the industry has. With the prices where they are, the amount of money that they get for saving that natural gas, it takes longer to make up the money that they've had to pay to install technologies that capture the methane, that monitor for leaks. And that's, you know, a common thing that you see when energy prices go down. It's always, there's always less of incentive to install pollution controls because these prices are low. Now, of course, natural gas prices are low as well. Not quite, we haven't seen quite the dramatic drop like we've seen in the oil price world. But, you know, those two things go hand in hand. When you drill for oil, you often get associated natural gas. So we're really talking about two sides of the same coin.
If these regulations are implemented, what that would be, if they should go through, that would be very early 2017, I think. Would we see some impact on the price of oil in the U.S. and the price of natural gas?
I don't think you could see really that much of an impact, especially because these don't get at existing wells. Now, if EPA, either this administration or the next one, I think that might have a greater impact. But I think prices for especially oil, since they're priced on a global market, there are so many other bigger factors that are going to have an impact on that than any one U.S. domestic regulation. Natural gas, too, I also think that the price for that will depend a lot more on demand and the electricity generation here in the U.S. than this particular regulation.
The industry is shouting back they don't want to do this, but really, how much impact will it have? The environmentalists say not nearly enough. Right now, with oil prices so low, the pace of new well creation drilling is very low, is it not? I mean, will this is there any impact?
Right. Well, I actually don't think there is a significant impact with this particular regulation. The costs and benefits are very small compared to a lot of the regulations that EPA has issued over the years. The concern that the industry has is that they really want to make sure EPA doesn't go into regulating existing sources. And the way that the Clean Air Act works is that if EPA pursues regulations of new sources under this part of the Clean Air Act, which it said this week it's doing, that technically legally require the eventual regulation of existing oil and gas wells. Now, EPA hasn't said when or if it will do that, but you can bet that environmentalists will be suing them to force that regulation. I don't think that will happen in this administration, merely because of the time on the time on the clock until Obama leaves office. But if a Democrat wins the White House in 2016, I anticipate that eventually you will see a direct regulation on existing wells. And that's what the industry really opposes. And that's why a lot of the industry is opposed to this regulation.
It seems like there's such a race on right now to get ahead of or try to climate change. I mean, we're seeing all these record numbers come in. What about other countries around the world? Would the U.S. be leading here or following in regulating, controlling methane emissions?
The U.S. has really taken the lead on methane emissions. The World Bank earlier this year did announce a commitment by several major countries and companies, including countries like Russia and others, to clamp down on methane emissions. So you are seeing progress on the global front as well. I think methane is the second most, you know, common greenhouse gas that we hear discussed in the realm of climate change talks. And so I think you're seeing progress, but not quite as much focus as you do on carbon dioxide.
And what about the cows? I'm reading here, I mean, 26% of the nation's methane comes from cattle industry. 29% from gas and oil. That's more, but not that much more. As long as we love beef, there's going to be a lot of cow pies and cow methane.
Right, exactly. You actually, there is an effort among some environmental groups to urge EPA to regulate the methane emissions from the cattle industry. And you can just imagine how angry that is going to make the cattle and farming industry. And
we'll hold that one for another day. Amy Harder, energy reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for being with us, Amy. We are talking about starting maybe to get a grip on methane. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about starting maybe to get a grip on methane, the gas that's worse than CO2 for global warming and is leaking out of our oil and gas infrastructure all over the place. Here's the sound of multi-well natural gas drilling in Barnett Shale region of Texas behind us here. EPA looking for new controls, modest at first, but they could go bigger. It's a big deal globally when it comes to global warming. Go to Fort Collins, Colorado right now, and Anthony Marchese, director of the Engines and Energy Conversion Laboratory, professor at the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Colorado State, lead author of a big study on methane emissions and their potency that's just come out this week, sponsored by the Environmental Defense Fund and five energy companies. Anthony Marchese, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Could you please talk to us about the potency of methane compared to what we hear a lot more about or have heard, CO2, carbon dioxide?
Well, yes, as Amy said earlier, it really depends on how you calculate it, but methane has 25 to 80 times the global warming potential of CO2. So on the one hand, if we burn methane, we would produce less CO2 in comparison to when we burn coal. That's why there's a big push to burn methane to generate power. But any methane that kind of sneaks out along the way has, you know, 25 times higher global warming potential than CO2. So we really have to make sure that we don't allow more than a percent or two of methane to leak out along the way.
Help us, we lay people here. So is methane, if you burn it, is it got the same impact as burning natural gas? Is it? What's the difference between methane and natural gas? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, natural gas, when it comes out of the ground, contains mostly methane. You know, it depends on the region. Some areas of the country, natural gas comes out of the ground, it's like 97-98% methane.
Okay.
And then other regions, it has a lot more heavier hydrocarbons, including oil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, generally it's mostly methane. And so when we talk about burning natural gas, you know, we're burning mostly methane. And I should also mention that pipeline quality natural gas, once it's processed and gets into the pipeline and ends up in your home,
mm-hmm.
It's at least 90% methane.
So when we see it let's say, burning off at a wellhead, is it better to burn it off than let the methane go straight into the atmosphere because it's somehow less potent as a global warming chemical?
Yes, and that's really one of the reasons that we flare it. So as Amy said earlier, the easiest thing to do would be to just vent it. The second easiest thing to do is to burn it. But, you know, when you think about it, when you're burning the natural gas at an oil well, that's a complete waste of energy. That natural gas could be used to generate energy. It could go into a pipeline somewhere. And, and that's what we see here on the Front Range in Colorado. We have a lot of mixed oil and gas operations, but we're in pretty close vicinity to natural gas pipelines. So we try to capture that natural gas and get it into the pipeline. But when you have areas like in North Dakota, they're sort of off the grid, so to speak. So they drill for oil, and they're not close enough to a pipeline to capture the natural gas, and so they burn it in a flare.
But with all that, we still pump out a lot of straight methane from our oil and gas sector, from processing facilities and wells and transmission and distribution lines. I mean, historically, has there been concern about that, or that was just, oh, never mind, just get the stuff in the truck or the pipeline or the rail car and off we go?
Yeah, it's a very, very complex system. I think most of the attention over the last 5 to 10 years has been on hydraulic fracturing and, you know, the environmental impacts thereof. But the wells are only a small part of the entire sector. So, you know, we typically go from, you know, 10 or 100 wells. The gas gets sent to a centralized facility called a gathering facility. That was one of the areas that our study focused on. And then a gathering facility has compressors and valves and fittings and a lot of equipment that leaks gas. And then from a gathering facility, it goes to a processing plant. And then from a processing plant, it could get into the natural gas transmission network. And the natural gas can travel 1,000 miles and go through, 10 more compressor stations along the way. And then finally, it gets to the city distribution system, which, as you know, has a lot of other potential for leaks. So, there's a lot of possibilities for these methane molecules to sneak out into the atmosphere along the way. And that was the major goal of EDF's series of studies, which was to
Your group,
try to really get a better handle.
Mm-hmm. Boy, it sounds like a lot of cost to get all that reined in. On the other hand, we've got all the urgency that comes right now with climate change. Anthony Marchese questions callers for you, if you'd be good enough to stand by there in Colorado. Kevin's calling from Belchertown, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I worked in the oil field for many years. Mm-hmm. I was drilling 110 wells a year. And
busy guy.
There's no, there's really no technology that exists at this point to capture the natural gas as it comes out of the drilling bud. It has to be flared. The cost of, collecting that gas and, directing it into a distribution line would be astronomical. You'd be running a pipeline to a well that you don't know is going to be successful.
Kevin, take us right there to the wellhead.
To do that.
Yeah. We get that. Hang on to that.
In order to...
Yeah. Take us right to the wellhead, Kevin. You said it comes out of the mud. So what's it look like? If we were standing at the very site of the drilling site, describe it for us and how the gas actually escapes.
Well, the gas as it's coming up to the surface is decreasing in pressure. It's bubbling out of the mud. And when the mud gets to the surface up through the casing, when it hits the surface, you have both the drilling mud, the rock cuttings that from the rock that you're drilling through.
Right.
And, if you've drilled through a gas-bearing formation, you're going to have natural gas coming into the mud.
So it's sort of like, bubbling and like belching out along with the drilling mud that makes it all possible, lubricates the whole thing.
Yes. And that gas, as it comes out, gets directed out with a flare line out away from the rig, so there's no explosion hazard, and they just stick a bucket out there full of diesel fuel that keeps it lit.
Mm-hmm.
you know, they light the bucket on fire, so there's a pilot light out there, and the natural gas just flares off. It's less bad for the environment than releasing it. You know, you're getting CO2.
Right, but it's not as bad as straight methane. Yeah.
But there's no way to collect it.
Kevin, that's a kind of reality check for us here, and I appreciate your call. Anthony Marchese, you're our, you know, big guy in mechanical engineering. At some level, it sounds like if you want to drill for oil and gas, you're going to lose methane. There's no economical way to capture it. Going after those fossil fuels in the first place makes it almost inevitable. Or am I wrong?
Well, as the caller mentioned, there are going to be some inevitable sources of methane leak. You know, that's the nature of the industry. But what the caller didn't mention is that there have been new rules and regulations put into place. And, you know, these green well completions is a great example. So, you know, a study that came out about 2 years ago, also sponsored by the EDF, was looking at methane emissions during natural gas drilling and, you know, hydraulic fracturing.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is dramatically lower methane emissions when folks were using this green completion technique. And this is where you actually try to capture that methane during what's called a well completion or a flowback. So, you know, there are technologies, there are approaches.
What about the cost? Our caller Kevin says it's going to cost you, it'll make it all uneconomical.
Obviously, and that's the issue. That's why, you know, the industry doesn't completely get behind these rules. I mean, as Amy had mentioned earlier on, you know, when we're losing 1 or 3% of our gas, that's money that's going right down the drain. And, you know, our study just on gathering and processing, you know, we're estimating $400 million in lost income for natural gas producers just from the methane emissions, just from this small fraction of natural gas operations. So that said, if it costs more to put in the environmental controls than those, you know, that lost income, then there's always going to be resistance.
You know, it's interesting, before people get too holier than thou, I mean, when you eat a hamburger, you're supporting the cattle industry. A lot of methane comes there. When you, I guess, put organic waste in the garbage, our landfills, looks to me from the numbers here, produce something like half of the methane released in this country. Am I right, Professor?
Well, that's right. There are many, many sources of methane. And, you know, I think you have to applaud, you know, the EPA and the administration for starting down this road to try to rein in the industry a little bit. Many of us don't believe that the regulations go far enough. As you mentioned earlier, you know, it's mostly just new wells and new infrastructure. But, you know, as our study shows, you know, the some 5,000 gathering facilities in the U.S., you know, they may be responsible for 20 or 30% of all methane emissions in the entire industry. And, you know, these are facilities that were, you know, largely ignored as a methane source. And you know, the other point, you know, you mentioned, you know, hamburgers and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all, you know, benefit from the energy industry. You know, we all use natural gas in our homes, and we use, you know, oil in our automobiles. And so, even if you're the staunchest environmentalist, like many of us are, we do have to recognize that we all benefit. And so, you know, we need to do better. And I think regulations help us do better. There's no question about that. But we have to recognize that, you know, particularly with regards to natural gas, I mean, we're never going to eliminate methane leakage, but we can get it down to 1%. If we get it down to 1%, I think we're going to be in very good shape.
Of course, we all benefit, as you say, although what we mean by benefit, we may put a jaundiced eye on in a few decades if the worst effects of climate change start to come down on us. We may wonder what we thought benefit meant. Anthony Marchese at Colorado State University, thank you very much for being with us today.
All right, thank you.
Here's Janet McCabe, Acting Assistant Administrator at the EPA's Office for Air and Radiation, talking about the goals of the new proposed rules in a conference call with reporters Tuesday.
We can continue to accelerate the transition to a clean energy economy by capturing fuel that would otherwise be wasted, while also preventing pollution that harms our climate and the health of our communities and families.
Modest steps, the EPA says, is proposing to capture methane. It is very potent when it comes to climate change. There are big supporters of doing this and more. There are also opponents. Conrad Schneider joins us right now from Brunswick, Maine. He's advocacy director at the Clean Air Task Force. Conrad Schneider, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Howard Feldman is here. He's Director of Regulatory and Scientific Affairs at the American Petroleum Institute, a big industry trade group. Howard Feldman, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Howard, do we need these regulations? I'm reading you all over the place saying no, 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 though some in your industry say yes.
So we don't need these regulations right now for this. We've already taken steps to reduce methane emissions. The previous regulations that were put in place in 2012 are working and are reducing emissions, and the industry is very incentivized to voluntarily reduce its emissions.
Is it really when oil prices are so low? We heard the Wall Street Journal reporters say the temptation to go cheap and dirty is great when prices are low.
Still, the industry is moving forward with it. We know that methane is our product. It's what we sell. It's the main component of natural gas, and the industry has been capturing it more and more. The EPA data show that trend. We know that from emissions from field production from 2005 have dropped 38%, and that's the EPA data. So we know that and that's largely even before the regulations came into effect. So we think the current regulations, with the industry's incentive towards voluntarily reducing emissions, are doing the job.
Conrad Schneider, 38% drop since 2005 sounds like progress. Who needs regulation?
Well, that figure is due to the regulations, largely. If the oil and gas industry could be trusted to police itself, it wouldn't have dumped 9 million tons of methane and other toxic chemicals like benzene into our air last year. That's enough gas to heat 6 million homes. So what we learned from the Colorado State gentleman, Anthony Marchese, was that these emissions are being underestimated right now, and EPA projects that they're going to go up by 25%. But, you know, we shouldn't be arguing about percentages here. This is about people's health and the health of our planet. And we can't wait any longer for regulations to protect us on this. We need the safeguards that EPA proposed, which are a great first step, in terms of controlling this problem.
But as Howard says, you know, this is product for the oil and gas industry. Methane is essentially natural gas. He says that's enough incentive right there to get them to do what they reasonably can to rein it in. What do you say?
Well, if that was true, they wouldn't have dumped it that much methane into the atmosphere in the past year. And over the past decades, and there have been opportunities for industry to step up and show that voluntary measures could work, but they haven't done that. EPA runs a program called GasStar that certifies when companies come in and do voluntary measures, and there's been a 1% participation rate by companies in that program. So we don't see trust in the industry as being the solution. The regulations that Howard mentioned that were put into place in 2012 are working. It's possible to capture gas when it's coming out, contrary to what the caller said. And so what we want is to see these new regulations that were just proposed this week cover, for example, the same emissions from oil wells and from all the different points on the system that Professor Marchese described, from the wellhead all the way down to the transmission pipelines. All we're asking from Mr. Feldman's industry is to keep your gas in your pipelines. And that's not happening right now, so regulation is necessary.
Conrad Schneider, please stand by at the Clean Air Task Force, joining us today from Brunswick, Maine, and Howard Feldman at the American Petroleum Institute in Washington. We are talking about getting a grip on methane, at least out of the oil and gas industries. Yes, the loss has been cut. It's been reined in, but there's still a lot out there. It is very potent. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, the sound of an oil rig in North Dakota right there in the oil fields. All kinds of gas and oil production around this country and lots of methane leakage. It's down, the industry says, but the EPA says it's time for regulations to begin to rein it in more. It's more potent than CO2, carbon dioxide, for global warming, and it is leaking out of our oil and gas infrastructure in many places these days. Let's go to Monroe in Aiken, South Carolina. Monroe, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I love your show and everything.
Thank you.
I just wonder, y'all were talking about cost earlier with the methane containing it. We're not talking about the cost that it involves with our damage to our environment and just to our infrastructure, like the flooding that happened recently and everything. A lot of places it costs up in the millions of dollars to repair this stuff. Of course, that increases insurance rates and things like that. So I think that them having to pay a cost to contain the methane is a small cost compared to all of us having to pay something else if we don't do so.
Monroe, I appreciate your call. Howard Feldman, how about it? Yes, it may be costly to do this, but look around the planet. We've got a lot of costs that are accruing as a result of climate change. Maybe it's worth it, even if it's expensive.
Yeah, and the industry would agree with that, that we are reducing emissions. The technologies that we've alluded to a couple of times in this segment, which are the reduced emission completion technology, was technology developed by the industry. The industry has been employing it, has been using it before there were regulatory requirements, and is expanding the use of that.
But Conrad says not enough, not fast enough, still too much escaping, we can't afford it.
Well, we're still moving in that direction, and the progress is steady. At the same time, we're in the middle of a shale revolution, which is driving our economy to new heights. So that is something good. And we're using more and more of this natural gas in power generation in the country. And by doing that, CO2 emissions are now down to 27-year lows through increased use of natural gas and power plants. So this is actually having a large benefit from a climate perspective.
Beats coal, and it just flows and flows. Here's a natural gas drill site operator talking about that.
You can hear the flowing of the gas. Yeah. This is 24/7. It doesn't shut off at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. This just flows. When you're going to sleep, this is one of your wells. It's constantly producing. This is what makes it neat. Winter, summer, fall, should keep producing.
It just flows and flows and flows and flows. Of course, so does the methane. Conrad, you're looking at the big picture here. Howard makes the argument, well, look, yes, there's some leakage, but we're working on it, and it's better than coal.
Look, we need to be able to reduce our climate forcing emissions from a lot of different sources, whether it's power plants, the gas industry, and so forth, if we're going to meet our climate targets and stop the damage that the caller referred to. Let's go to the question of cost, though. You know, the EPA proposed the rule, and so it's just a proposal this week, but when we looked at it, we found that it would cost about roughly a cent for a million cubic feet of gas produced. An MCF of gas today is worth about $3. So we're talking about one penny for $3 worth of value here, and that's not going to put anybody out of business. So we can get the benefits of reducing the methane emissions. They're so potent, particularly in the near term, that what we're concerned about, where we're seeing the direct impacts of climate change today. And we can get them throughout the system. There's, you know, Howard was focusing on what happens at the well, and that's where his members are most concerned. Mm-hmm. But the system that Anthony Marchese described is more than that. It's all the pipelines, it's all the processing plants, all the gathering lines, and so forth. And we have technology now, which is infrared technology, almost like night vision goggles, where we can go out and see what was otherwise invisible, these leaks from these valves and seals and so forth. And all these regulations would require, and these sensible safeguards would require, is to go in and fix those problems, fix the seals, fix the valves, plug the leaks. That's what we're asking for. That's a reasonable, common sense set of safeguards.
That is a huge system. I mean, I don't doubt that you're correct that it's leaking all over the place. But when you think about the entire gas distribution system in this country and getting that leak free or much lower, that sounds like a whole lot of money. Maybe it casts doubt on the on fossil fuels themselves as our energy source, but they are our primary energy source.
Yeah, the cost that we're talking about here, on this rule, a penny.
That's this rule, but you're bringing in pipelines everywhere. We've got pipelines, I've read, a century old.
We do, and some of those need to be replaced and put people to work doing them. But there is technology now to quickly find these leaks, as I'm saying, through these infrared cameras, and it's fantastic. Go to our website and see the technology there.
What about the other big producers here, cattle and landfill? You're focused today on the industry, but what about agriculture? It produces an awful lot of methane, almost as much as the gas and oil industry. And what about landfill that we all could contribute, quote unquote, to?
Well, EPA did take action late last week about landfills, but when you look, let's compare the agricultural sector to the oil and gas industry for just a second.
Okay.
So the infrastructure of the oil and gas system is large. But it's finite. You can find it. It's a pipeline. It's a compressor. It's a valve. Think about the agriculture sector and how dispersed all those sources are.
Cattle all over.
Acres and acres of land, and we're talking about many, many animals. So we think the administration made the right decision to begin with the oil and gas industry because it could attack the problem in a very specific way.
Julia in Medway, Massachusetts. Julia, you're on the air.
Hey there. So I'm an energy consultant for Solar City, and I think what's, something huge that's being presented now with this argument is that, we have the ability to choose where we want our energy from. So if, fracking and the acquisition of oil and, creating electricity is causing these emissions to be put into the atmosphere, I think it's a call to action on a smaller scale for people to really, think about and make those smaller choices that can lead to, huge, huge outcomes for our environment.
Julia, I appreciate your call. Howard Feldman, how about it? You represent fossil fuels here. If you don't get a bigger, better handle on methane, might you come up against more pressure to get out of fossil fuels entirely?
I think the government forecasts going forward clearly show that we will be using fossil fuels as the dominant source of our energy for the next set of decades. So the best way we can proceed is to use these fuels in the best way, cost-effective, common-sense regulation that built on existing controls that we already have in place. So that's what we've been advocating in terms of the technology that Mr. Schneider was talking about. That's the same technology that our members use to find leaks, and they are out there detecting leaks in their facilities because they're incentivized to do that.
Conrad Schneider, what's your estimate, your assessment here of lobbying power? Who's got the weight of sway? Are we likely to see these regulations kick in?
Well, listen, there's no question that the oil and gas industry is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, energy lobby in the country. That's why it's important to recognize that the Obama administration is standing up and saying enough. That they are taking the first step this week to start to rein in the methane for these first ever proposed methane regulations. So that shows courage and strength to be able to take that on. I'm sure there will be calls in Congress to roll these back and to stop them. But fortunately, members of Congress, including from Western oil and gas producing states, have been supportive of this effort. So we believe that these regulations that were proposed this week should go final in 2016 and take effect. And as we say, it's a great first step.
Conrad Schneider with the Clean Air Task Force joining us today from Brunswick, Maine. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Howard Feldman with the American Petroleum Institute. Thanks for talking methane with us today, Howard.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, where the world stands ahead of the big upcoming UN climate change conference in Paris, this is On Point. It's not the first time global leaders have tried to come to an agreement on climate change. The Kyoto Protocol was the first big push. In Copenhagen in 2009, leaders came close to an agreement on limiting greenhouse gases, but failed to produce a legal treaty. It was a big disappointment for environmentalists. In December, governments from around the world will once again meet in Paris to try to create a new global agreement on climate change that outlines what each country will do. The stakes are high, as global temperatures continue to rise. And it's still unclear whether across the globe individual nations' pledges will be enough to make a real difference. Joining me now from Washington is Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter for the New York Times. Coral, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, great to be with you, Tom.
So Copenhagen was described in almost in tears by some environmentalists when it fell apart. Does Paris look more promising? Are the nations who will be attending lining up with commitments that could add up to a binding treaty on everybody that would make a real difference in our path on climate change?
Well, there's a couple of things that are really different about the march towards this Paris Agreement. And the first is, you know, in Copenhagen, all the negotiators kind of came to the table and were hashing out, you know, during that summit, well, what are you going to do and what are you going to do and what are you going to do? The difference with the Paris Agreement, it's structurally different and it's really important, is that in the months ahead before the agreement, in other words, sort of what's been happening over the past few months and the next month or two, countries are putting forth their concrete plans for what they're going to do at home to cut emissions. And the heart of this Paris Agreement is that every country in the world is going to put forth a plan, and they're going to put it forth several months before they actually, you know, get together. So by the time, so over 40 countries, including the U.S. and China, the world's two largest emitters, have already put forth their plans. The plans are public. They're on a U.N. website. You know, every government can see what every other government is already doing. And so the idea is, you know, by the time the world leaders head to Paris in December, most of what is going to be done is already going to be known. They're not going to be haggling over, you know, my country will do this and your country won't do that. So that, you know, it's a very different dynamic, and it means that there is the likelihood that we'll see an agreement that commits every country in the world to enacting some kind of domestic policy. You mentioned one thing, will there be a treaty? And the answer to that is almost certainly no. And that's an issue. You know, the terms, a treaty is a legally binding document that in the United States would have to be ratified by the U.S. Senate.
Yep.
It's basically politically impossible for that to happen. The U.S. has made clear, you know, President Obama has made clear to other world leaders, if you know, they don't want a repeat of Kyoto, where they forced a treaty, brought it home, and the Senate refused to ratify it. So that's where you kind of get into some international legal jujitsu. How do you get something that countries will commit to that will, you know, have countries moving forward, taking actions at home, but that isn't, you know, doesn't have that hard, legally binding quality of a treaty? That's a very significant balancing act, and it's still a question.
It sounds a lot easier to put up a lovely plan when it's not legally binding. Does that mean countries may be coming forward and saying, we'll do this or that, but if it's not legally binding, does it really have the weight of commitment that circumstances require?
Well, so there's a couple of things. What countries are doing is, you know, they're saying, these are the actions we're going to take at home. This is how we're going to do them. We're going to use our own, you know, this is what we're going to enact. A lot of countries are pointing to things that they've already done. And so the idea is, countries are coming forward and they're saying, this is what we can do within our government at home domestically, rather than sort of, you know, a top-down UN treaty assigning countries, or UN agreement assigning countries to go back and do things. And so the thinking on this is that, you know, countries are going to bring forward, you know, what they politically and pragmatically can do, and that increases the likelihood that it's actually going to happen. As you say, you know, without the legally binding force of a treaty, it does raise questions. You know, will they follow through with what they say they're doing? And in this case, the negotiators are trying to create sort of a public, an international name and shame system. They strategically worked on is, every country puts forward publicly, you know, countries have already put forward publicly what they're going to do. They'll be open to, you know, an international system where other, you know, there'll be a groups coming in, monitoring countries, countries will have to come and give presentations and saying, here's what we said we're going to do. These are our numbers. Are we, you know, in the following years, are we meeting them or not? And so the question is, does that work? I mean, does that sort of, you know, if you're subject to the, you know, going to the UN and putting forth these things publicly and saying, this is what we said we're going to do, and now we're not doing it. Does that work? You know, that's a real question. You know, people who work on these say there are examples of international agreements that have worked because of, you know, this sort of international political peer pressure. On the other hand, there might be countries that just, you know, don't really care if they don't meet this, and there are no legal consequences.
There's a lot on the line here. Here was Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General in the Arctic in July, talking with France 24.
While we have been talking without taking any concrete action, the climate change and nature has been deteriorating. This is the only place where we can live. We have to really nurture and take care of our planet Earth.
Coral Davenport, we've just got half a minute here. You said the U.S. and China are already out there with their plans. They're the two biggest. Do they, we're waiting for others, but do those two make it look like we're on track here? Would their plans make it suggest that we could get ahead of climate change, or are we doomed?
There is no expectation that this agreement will stop climate change, just to be clear. Scientists have said clearly that, in order to stop the worst impacts of climate change, we'll need to stop emissions enough to stop a global increase in temperatures of 2 degrees Celsius. There's no expectation that this agreement will get there.
We got to get busy, even beyond Paris. Coral Davenport, energy and environment reporter with the New York Times. Thank you very much for being with us. Thanks to all of our guests today. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.